Okay. Well, that's all right. Real quickly, let's set Hebrews 11 in the broader context of the book. This is probably one of the most beloved passages in the book of Hebrews, and maybe one of the most beloved passages in the New Testament because of this parade of examples of faith that is so encouraging. But we want to think about this in terms of the inspired writer and his audience as to why he picks this particular method to encourage them practically at the close of his book. And of course, one of the things that they're being tempted to do, and one of the things that the inspired writer is trying to keep them from doing, is they're being tempted to go back to the old ways, to sort of default to what they have known for probably most of their lives as Jewish converts to Christianity, go back to the old law. And he says, you can't do that. That's not going to get you where you want to go. It does not provide an answer to sin. It is not going to reconcile you to God. Jesus is better in every way, and the whole law has been pointing toward Him. But, very wisely, I think what he does in chapter 11 is he says, okay, there is something you can go back to legitimately. You can go back to faith, which is what the whole reason that he is writing this letter is because there's a danger that they are straying from that. He said, if you want to go back to something, go back to faith. And he looks at the faith of their fathers in terms that will support, in every kind of way, support continued faithfulness to Jesus Christ. And he's going to show some common themes throughout this chapter that point to the fact that men of faith have always faced the same kinds of challenges and always responded in the same kinds of ways. And they've always been seeking after things not seen as opposed to things seen. They've always trusted in the promises of God, and they've always done this in the context of resistance and persecution and difficulty. And very often, they've done it in a kind of a way that's been less than ideal. There have been some bumps in the road, and we're certainly going to see that in these examples, that the thing that recommends many of these people is not that their execution of their trust in God was perfect. The thing that recommends them is when they did fail, they didn't quit. And that is what the Hebrew writer wants to drive home. And so we're going to see some examples and some situations that probably aren't the sort of cape and boots that we would like to see. You know, these aren't superheroes. These are people. And they definitely, some of the things he points back to when we go back and we look at it and we say, well, that's, yes, but it was not, it was a little rough, it was a little rocky, it was a little bumpy, it was a little messy. Yes, it was. And that's the point, because they live in a rough, bumpy, rocky, messy world like everybody else. And they need to see this. They need to see the fact that it's not some sort of comic book example, but it's real people facing real problems with real struggles. And they did struggle, but they didn't quit. And that's what he wants them to see. They didn't quit. They stumbled, they fell, but they didn't quit. And so that hopefully will sort of set Hebrews 11 into the context of their circumstance and hopefully give us some things to think about as we sort of work through this chapter and why it's important to the Hebrew writer's practical argument. So I'm just going to go ahead and throw this up real quick. Okay, so diving into some of what we touched on last time, faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. Okay, and so this is not, I don't think he's attempting a technical, full-orbed definition of faith. He's talking about faith in the sense that he wants to drive home to his listeners. It is the assurance of what they're hoping for, and what they're hoping for is of what nature? Is it visible and physical and tangible? No, what they're hoping for is unseen. It's, and he's going to make much of that in chapter 12 when he talks about coming to a mountain that cannot be shaken and a city that is heavenly and spiritual. But yeah, their hope is for unseen things, and that's going to be a dominant theme throughout this chapter, that we have people who are trusting in things that they cannot physically see. Now, that doesn't mean it's a blind leap of faith, and we'll talk about that as we work through this, but they are trusting in things that they cannot see. And he states his point, by it the men of old gained approval. And so we're at a critical juncture here, because he's saying to them, look, you don't please God by a lack of faith, which is what you're in danger of doing, is in going back to the old law. You are shrinking back to destruction, as he's already said in chapter 10. Don't do that. The men of old, all the people that you revere, gained approval through faith. And then he talks about in verse 3 something of the nature of faith. He says, by faith, we understand that the worlds were prepared by the word of God, so that what is seen is not made out of things which are visible. This has been suggested, this is the clearest statement of ex nihilo creation, that is creation from nothing, perhaps in all of the Bible. But the point is that, and this is in, I don't want to get too far afield here, but this is in sharp distinction to just about every other conception of the way the world came into being that there is, okay? Most accounts of creation, went along the lines of Bel slaying divine Tiamat and cutting her in two and taking the parts of her and making the world out of this. Of course, she is representative of primeval chaos, and he slew her, and he, from the chaos, he brings order. And so that was a very typical explanation of things. One of the things where the Jews differed from most of the rest of the world in their time was that God spoke the world into existence. He doesn't take stuff that's already laying around. He brings it into existence by his very word. But then, now they all believe that. He's speaking to a commonly held belief. But how many of them saw that happen? How many of them witnessed that? Exactly. That's a mathematically correct answer. None. None of them saw it. None of them. But they believed that very definitely. And he says, you haven't seen it, but you take that on faith. And I think there are good reasons to take that on faith. That's beyond the scope of this class. But I think there are good reasons to take that on faith. And certainly, to some extent, whatever you say about how the universe came to be as it is that not a statement of faith? I mean, whether it's right or wrong, Did anybody see the universe come into existence? Has anybody witnessed that other than God? Has anybody watched that happen? No. So, I mean, Richard Dawkins is making assertions on faith too. I think he's putting his faith in some things that don't warrant that, but whatever you say, it's a statement about faith. And I think there's an important subtext here about faith. Nobody operates in this world apart from faith. People have faith in things they cannot see all day, every day. Okay, we put our trust in all kinds of things. And some of those things, without a great deal of evidence or reason. Now, you all drove in here today, and you drove in here with the confidence that the other people on the road are going to stop at the red lights and go at the green lights. I tell you, that is a belief for which the evidence in Lexington, as far as I can tell, is pretty thin. Well, amen, brother. So, but we operate on that premise, okay? You know, so we expect. We don't know those other people. We don't know anything about them. But we have faith that they're going to go along and do what the traffic law. So we exhibit faith in things all the time. All day, every day. We have certain expectations based on things that we don't know or are not in a position to have knowledge about. And so the idea that anyone could operate strictly on principles of science without faith is ridiculous in the extreme. We all put faith in something. The Hebrew writer wants to drive home the idea that you need to make sure the thing you're putting your trust in is worthy of that trust. And he's going to make a case for God. Any thoughts or comments sort of on these first three verses? If not, I want to get into the examples. And we're not going to spend just a ton of time on these. But if you're not satisfied with how much time we spend sort of going back and looking at these examples, Alan is going to teach an entire class next quarter on Hebrews 11, and he's going to do a deep dive into these. And so I think that will be a really worthy study, and I recommend that to you. He starts out here with Abel, and he says, "By faith Abel offered to God a better sacrifice than Cain, through which he obtained the testimony that he was righteous, God testifying about his gifts through faith. And though he is dead, he still speaks." Okay? And so, let's go back very quickly to Genesis 4 and look at this. Look at this example in brief. "Came about in the course of time that Cain brought an offering to the Lord of the fruit of the ground. Abel, on his part, brought the firstlings of his flock and their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and for his offering, but for Cain and for his offering he had no regard. So Cain became very angry and his countenance fell." And the only comment we get in Genesis is the comment that God makes in the very next verse, the verse we didn't read, where God says to Cain, after it says his countenance fell, he says, "If you do well, will not your countenance be lifted?" And so we don't know anything about what God had asked for. We know that Abel is said to have given the first, and that Abel's offering was sacrifice of animals. All of those things have been suggested as being the key thing. But clearly there's a standard here, even if we're not aware of it, they were. Abel apparently knows what he should have done and didn't do. Cain, knows what he should have done and didn't do. But instead, he decides to get rid of his brother. But the question is, what is the Hebrew writer wanting us to see here? He offered a better sacrifice than Cain and obtained a testimony that he was righteous. He did the right thing. God testifying about his gifts. And through faith, and here's the key, I think, in this example. Through faith, because he trusted God, even though he is dead, he still speaks. And so, this is not the whole argument, you understand, okay? It's just an introduction. But he goes back to the very, arguably the first time where you have a good example and a bad example set alongside one another, juxtaposed. And he says, look, that the thing that Cain was trying to do is silence his brother's good example so that he wouldn't look bad. Was he able to do that? No. Abel still speaks. Even they're both dead now. And still Abel is speaking. And so he looks at this idea and introduces this idea that those who operate by faith latch on to something that transcends death. Okay, now he hasn't fully developed what that is. But even in this example where we don't have a whole lot of information, he points out that Abel connected to something through faith that transcends death. And he's still talking to us. He's still speaking to us through his example, through his trust in God. And death could not silence that. Death could not overcome that. And so it sort of looks like in the immediate sense, and this is why I think Abel is such a good example. It looks like he had a kind of a poor reward for his faithfulness, doesn't it? I mean, he trusts God and does the right thing, and he's murdered. But that could not silence him. Could not silence his message. And he is still speaking. And so he points out that faith overcame in this situation. And of course, the message is, likewise, in their situation, faith will overcome. Now he's going to, again, he hasn't done everything he's going to do. I don't think we need to push this example too far, because he's going to talk about the nature of this overcoming and what it's connected to, and a lot of those things when he gets down into Abraham and some of the others. But here immediately, he points out that faith was victorious over death in a very real way that they can see. Thoughts, questions, comments? Okay. So next, he goes to Enoch. And Enoch is, it's interesting. We have two genealogies in Genesis, one in Genesis 4 and one in Genesis 5. And in Genesis 4, the seventh sort of descendant in the genealogy is pulled out and highlighted. And the seventh guy in the line is Lamech. And Lamech is a polygamist and a murderer and a braggart. Other than that, he seems to be a pretty fine fellow. But he's not a good guy. And then we get to the other genealogy through Seth. And the seventh guy in that line is pulled out and highlighted. And that is Enoch. And so there's clearly a comparison going on here. Lamech is typical of one line and Enoch is typical of the other line. And what do we know about Enoch? What does the text say in Genesis 5 about Enoch? What did he do, first of all? What are we told that was characteristic of Enoch? Yeah, he lived faithfully. He walked with God. And what was the result of that? Yes, God took him. There's a story about a little girl in a Bible class, and she explained it this way, that Enoch walked with God, and he walked with God so long that at the end of their walk, they were closer to God's house than they were Enoch's, and so God said, just come on home with me. And that kind of a childlike way of seeing it, but not a bad, if you take the sort of spatial aspect out of it and think about it spiritually, not a bad description of what happened. Enoch was taken up so that he would not see death, and he was not found because God took him. For he obtained the witness before his being taken up. He was pleasing to God. And so now he's moved the ball considerably down the field at this point, because he's connected faith to what outcome? Being with God. Exactly. The lip reading is getting a little better. Being with God. And so that's right. And now he's driven this home. He's shown that in the first example that faith in some sense overcomes death. Now he takes it to the next step. All right. If you trust in God, if you remain faithful to the Lord, then you will be with him. And then he makes this sort of statement in verse 6 that again is well known: without faith it is impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe what, first of all? Yeah, that he is. Okay? That he is. Now, is it enough to believe in the existence of God? Or are there some things you have to believe about God that are necessary? Okay, it's not enough just to believe there is a God. A lot of people will affirm that. I believe there is a God. And the thing that he highlights here, I think there's probably more than believe that he is probably more than just there is something that we might call God. But certainly the thing that he brings out is that he is a rewarder of those who seek him. Now there are all kinds of implications in that statement. When it says he is a rewarder of those who seek him. Okay? So implicit in that statement is that God is a personal God, not just a force, because of the whole aspect of rewarding and seeking sort of necessitates that. That he's intelligent in making judgments about the nature of seeking and all that sort of thing. And so God is intelligent. He is personal. He is faithful. That's implicit in that statement. He rewards those who seek Him. He can be counted on to do what He says He's going to do, to follow through on the reward. So He's personal. He's faithful, just, and to some degree, at least implicit in this statement, to some degree powerful, because he's in a position to follow through on what he does. And so there are a lot of things sort of that have to go with this statement about God. I think it says when he is, that also necessitates him being eternal and self-existent. At least in the Jewish mind, they could not have thought of God in any other way. Right.
And what you just brought out is critical. Our faith is not misplaced because of who God is. You can't lie. He's always come through. Great track record. 100%.
Right.
And I think to a large degree, I think the bulk of what God's servant is teaching us here is about hope. Faith validates that hope.
Right. Right.
He doesn't just expect this or that. He rewards. God is pleased with those who trust in Him, who genuinely trust in Him. And whatever the sacrifice, because they're going through so many sacrifices in this this time period, it's worth it because of what your hope is. It's worth it. And so just like these people were willing to undergo, go through whatever, the hope motivated, it was the incentive, it's all they needed. And it was made real because of the person who promised it, their faith in that person who promised it. But to a large degree, this is a chapter on hope. It's a chapter on what we have to look forward to. And hope in the midst of a dark time is extremely powerful.
Right.
Not only for these people, but those who are watching them, observing them, you know, look how they continue in spite of. Look at these people. What's driving them? What's their motivation? And you know, a great opportunity then to share that hope, 1 Peter 3:15.
Right. And of course the point the Hebrew writer is making is hope is predicated on, if we think about an earnest expectation of a desired outcome, hope is predicated on trusting the one who is sort of the guarantor of the hope, the one who's going to deliver on the hope. And so I think that's a great point that the Hebrew writer is making, this point that you cannot separate biblical faith and biblical hope. They're not two things. And probably we could lump love into there too, but that's not really at the forefront here. But they're not two things. They're two aspects of the same thing. And further, I think we need to say that he's saying at the front of this is, okay, because let's think about their circumstance. They're suffering, okay? They're God's people and they're suffering. And so there are a couple of ways, there are several ways to interpret that, potential ways to interpret that, okay? We are suffering because God doesn't care. Okay? To which the Hebrew writer would say, if you feel that way, you don't know this God. Because that's not who He is. So the lack, you have a flawed understanding of who God is. You don't know Him. Bad theology. That's not the case. That's not a legitimate interpretation of these events, because that's not who God is. Okay, now we all probably have been in a situation where we heard something about somebody and we immediately said, I don't believe it because I know them. And that's not who they are. And I understand that sometimes people disappoint us, but God doesn't. And so that is not a possibility. Mark that. It's not that God doesn't care. Okay? God is angry at us because we're doing the wrong thing in trying to seek Him through Jesus Christ. That's another possible interpretation. But the Hebrew writer has been at great pains in the first 10 chapters of the book to knock that off and point out the fact that everything that God has done has been pointing toward this. Of course, that's not the case. And so, the third possibility, it seems to me, and maybe there are others, but the third possibility is God is a loving and concerned Father who is chastening you for your good, and you're going to have to trust Him while that's going on, knowing that the outcome will be better than you ever possibly could have imagined. And when you go through this, as difficult as it is, you need to understand you're not the first person to go through this. Many others have gone through this. They have understood that God chastens those whom He loves. Okay? So, He hasn't made that point yet, but He's going to. He says, don't forget that. When He finally does say it, He's going to say, don't forget that. Don't forget that God chastens whom He loves. And so, if you know God, you know who He is, what kind of God He is, then you will come to understand and explain your circumstances in a way that is consistent with who He is, what He's done, and what He wants for you. And that will lead you to peace and faith and hope. And so it's essential, at the bedrock foundation of all of this, is we've got to know who God is. If we don't know God, we don't know the kind of God He is and the kinds of things He wants, then we are in an exceedingly vulnerable position when things turn bad, because there's a great likelihood that we will interpret those things wrongly. And there's a big long, you could do a shadow Hebrews 11 as well, of a list of people that interpreted God's nature and character wrongly and perished in consequence. I'm kind of glad we got this Hebrews 11. We got the light side Hebrews 11 and not the dark side Hebrews 11. He sort of gave us the dark side in chapters 3 and 4 when He talked about the generation that died in the wilderness. But in all those like them. Thoughts or questions about about verse 6 or anything there? Okay, let's look at Noah here very quickly. By faith, Noah, being warned by God about these things not yet seen, in reverence prepared an ark for the salvation of his household, by which he condemned the world and became an heir of the righteousness which is according to faith. And so, Noah's warned about what here in Genesis 6:13 and following? What does God say is coming in just 6:13 and 14 there? There's going to be a flood that's going to kill everybody. Has that been a fairly regular occurrence up to this point? No, it's something that Noah's never seen. Some people argue he'd never seen rain, period. I don't know if that's right. Maybe it is. But he's certainly never seen that. Okay? It's a thing not seen. It's a thing outside of his experience or anybody's experience. Okay? And did he believe that the thing that he had never in his life ever seen was going to happen? Yet, how do we know? Yeah, because you don't spend that much time building a boat if you don't believe. Of course he believed. God said he was going to do it. He said, I believe it. And so how did he condemn the world? And he may have done this in his preaching, But that's not what I'm looking for. I'm looking for how he condemned the world in this passage. Yeah, he did it by building the boat. He did it by trusting God while others did not. Because outside of Noah's family, how many other people believed that this was a real thing that was going to happen? Yeah, nobody. Nobody. And so his example of faith in something not seen. Now that's huge for this chapter. That's going to be a dominant theme throughout this. That the thing that is being looked for and hoped for is something not seen. Okay? Now, let's think about some things that they can't see and we can't see. Okay? The temple. Okay, the Jews have a temple that can... They don't now, but... Okay, then... The Jews had a temple that could be seen. All right, they had a physical temple, and surely that was a point of friction between Jews and Jewish converts to Christianity. Surely that was a point of friction. But Christians have a temple, but it's a temple that can't be seen. Jews have an altar from which they eat. Christians do too, but it's not a visible physical altar. There's a high priest that can't be seen. There's a sacrifice that was seen, but it was not seen being carried into the Holy of Holies. Okay? It was not seen. Nobody saw the high priest carry the sacrifice into the presence of God, because that happened where? And so he's talked about all these things that are in fact realities, but they're spiritual realities. They're not seen. And all of those things stand as a guarantee of a hope that is not seen. And so there's not seen upon not seen upon not seen in this situation. Now, again, that doesn't mean there's no physical evidence. What is the physical evidence for all these not seen things? Yeah, the resurrection happened. The death, burial, and resurrection happened. That was seen. And so it's not without evidence. This is not Disney faith. This is not the sort of faith, if I just believe, it will happen. That's nice in fairy tales, but it's not true. Okay? It's the problem. The significant thing about faith is not how much you believe in a thing. It's how worthy the thing you believe in is. It's the object of the faith that is the most significant thing. You can have all the faith in the world, but if you put that faith in something that's not worthy of it, you will be disappointed. And so it's the object of the faith. The object of this faith is Jesus Christ. The evidence for these not seen things was something that was very much seen, and that is the death, burial, and resurrection. It was seen by a lot of folks. Obviously, the death and the burial was seen by a lot of folks, but the resurrection, too, more than 500. And so that's been seen, and that stands as a guarantee. And so there's reason for faith. But much of what they're putting their trust in are things not seen, and their hope is certainly something not seen, because their hope's a heavenly hope. And the Hebrew writers make the point that's always been the case. That was the deal with Noah, is that he had to trust that something that he had never seen and nobody he had had any experience with had ever seen was going to happen. He becomes an heir of righteousness because he trusted in those things that are not seen. I think I just got buzzed, so... We will pick up next time with Abraham. Thank you.